So during my time in banking, really, I kind of got disillusioned with the system, so to speak. You know, I thought it was inefficient. So my role as a trader, I think in this day and age with a lot of technology, direct market access, you're not really creating much value.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is David Jelly, the founder of Property Bridges. This episode is all about psychology and psychology of investing. Here's my chat with David. Going green, becoming more sustainable, it's everywhere, right? Everyone wants to be greener and do their bit to help. But sometimes, for your business, there are more important things to do. It's hard to find the time. Well, take it out of your hands because it's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. They have the time and the experts to sort it for you. And the best bit is, it'll help your business, save you time, money, and energy. Perfect, right? The Green for Business audit will assess your business and tell you where you can make changes, and the new energy efficiency grant will help you pay for those changes. And your local enterprise office will sort the whole process for you. Go to www.allinadayswork.ie/green, fill out the form that takes less than 2 minutes, and your local enterprise office will take it from there. Going green? It's all in a day's work for your local enterprise office. Many of you listening to the pod are business owners and savvy investors, but have you been introduced to peer-to-peer lending? Peer-to-peer lending is the practice of lending money directly to other individuals or businesses without the need for a traditional intermediary like a bank. Property Bridges offers you the opportunity to lend directly to experienced home builders across Ireland through their innovative online investment platform. Investors earn returns of up to 9% per annum, and your money is fully secured against property. To learn more, visit propertybridges.com. Property Bridges is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of the Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today. David, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Gary. Happy to be here.
You've got a challenge for me. You boldly, off camera, said, I've got a challenge for you. Hit me.
I do have a challenge. So I think you're investing 100 quid a week into crypto, or 100 quid a week into the stock market.
10 a day into crypto, 10 a day into the stock market. So 70 a week into each.
And are you buying single stocks? You buying an ETF or what?
ETF. So I just want to do the Fortune 500.
Okay.
And then just Bitcoin. I'm very basic when it comes to investment. That's why you're here. You're going to give me the golden ticket for investing. So give me the challenge.
So, well, the challenge would be to, we would open an account on Property Bridges.
Okay.
We would seed that account with some money.
Okay.
And we would challenge you that over 3 years, that you make a higher return on Property Bridges than playing the stock market. So ETFs is a little bit different, but if you wanted to pick single stocks and kind of day trade, or not day trade, but trade in and out of stocks like over the 3 years, we'd like to challenge you that returns would be greater on our platform than would be in the stock market.
I'm in. I can never. Great. You're the second person to challenge me today. That says probably a lot about me and my psychology. And I said yes to both. I'm in.
Good.
Let's do it.
Off camera, then we'll decide on the wager, then the amount that we're going to.
We'll have to have a wager, yeah. But we'll have to have a forfeit as well. We'll have to have some sort of like forfeit that we both have to do.
I think so. But it has to be, there has to be a monetary value to it, because when you're day trading and there's no kind of downside risk, you trade differently.
Yeah.
So there has to be, like, when you're trading with your own money, you can make different decisions. So there has to be some kind of financial risk involved.
Oh, 100%. There has, like, yeah. I've done all those kind of simulations and I lose interest after like a day. Yeah. because it's not real. Like, I'm a very steady Eddie, though. I just invest in like the same things, all the basic stuff like Amazon, Google, Shopify, Tesla. You're very stereotypical.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's interesting to get your perspective on that. Like, whenever we turn on the financial news, like 95%, 99% is the stock market, it's US stocks. Mm. And I often wonder, like, what, you know, why don't people think more about alternative investments like what we provide? Or I know you had Chris Burge on from Spark Crowdfunding as well. So it'd be interesting just to get your thoughts on, you know, why is it crypto, the stock market, and, you know, you haven't thought about...
Good question. I guess accessibility and awareness.
Yeah.
I suppose, I'm just thinking as we're chatting now, I suppose accessibility and awareness. I remember when I started in crypto, a mate of mine, we're just having breakfast one morning, and I never knew what he did.
Yeah.
We'd go for breakfast every day, and he was a new mate. Like, we were training together, we were doing this program, and I would go for breakfast to miss the traffic, and he'd be like, I'll go with you. And I'd be like working away on my laptop, and he'd be just sitting shooting shit with me. I'm like, after about 3 weeks, I kind of felt I knew him well enough to go, what do you do? Because he never seemed to do a whole lot. And he's like, oh, I design websites. I was like, all right, fair enough, that's pretty logical. And after about 2 more weeks, I was like, what kind of websites? And peeled the onion, and he was heavily involved in crypto, and that's, I was like, what is this? And I remember back then, I was only having this chat with someone recently, actually, someone that worked at Coinbase, and I was chatting to them, telling them, like, trying to buy crypto in 2016 was so convoluted.
Yeah, yeah.
You had to go through this, and you had to go through that. And I think it's just awareness. Like, I think COVID brought a lot of people's awareness to crypto and to the financial markets. I think people had a lot of time in their hands. I watched that, I was traveling on the weekend on a ferry, and they had that Dumb Money movie. You know, the movie about... GameStop short.
Yeah.
It was actually really good. It was really interesting. It's really, really good. So I think it's awareness
and accessibility. Mainly, like, accessibility. You're right on, like,
people are afraid.
Yeah.
Everyone's afraid to make very interesting stats, actually. You'll enjoy this. I was only looking at it this morning. So 50 people, I think, signed up for my compounding challenge.
Yeah.
And then after 4 weeks, how many are still active?
10. 4. Wow. Yeah.
And I'm even surprised at that, because I've done loads of little experiments. It's the clue is in the name of the pod, but I was surprised.
So what is your compounding challenge?
So I said, look, I'm going to do this
because
I'm producing more kind of experimental content this year, because, you know, putting some skin in the game. Like you said, if you don't have skin in the game, you don't learn.
Yeah.
So I'm always about having skin in the game, and it's just 10 euros a day. And I want to kind of like be more personally active in investing, learning more. Yeah. And I think I only learn by doing. So I was like, well, I'll do 10 a day, because that's chunky enough to kind of make you sit up and pay attention, and then 10 a day into stocks as well, and just compare and contrast. And it got a good bit of attention, and people were like all in, and then it dropped off straight away.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to do it over the year to kind of go, I talk about Atomic Habits all the time. Mm. It's the book I reference every single week. People are sick of me talking about it, but it's just so powerful, because consistency is one thing we all lack.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all excited, and everyone wants to be an investor, and everyone wants to be financially secure, but we lack that foresight to go, how will this feel in a year? How will this feel in 10 years? Mm. And that's a great example of, like, and this is an engaged audience. These are smart people. Like, you know, people listen to Potter, super intelligent, as we know.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're engaged, right? They're mostly business owners or aspiring business owners, financially savvy, you know, but even at that level, people still drop off through fear and kind of like self-doubt, I think.
Yeah, and I guess that's what separates people from becoming successful over the years, when you combined every day, you know, over the weeks and months, and people that fall away.
It's boring, right?
Yeah.
It's really boring. Because, you know, you don't get that hit of adrenaline. You don't get that rush of like, oh, look, it's gone up or whatever. And you shouldn't think about it. I don't think about it. Like, you're asking me about stocks and shares. I don't think about it. I buy it and then leave it. Buy things. I actually have a good framework for it. I buy things that I think when my daughter is 18, we could sell.
Yeah.
And it just gives me that framework of like, don't buy the next hot thing. Buy things you think are popular now and will continue to be popular.
Yeah, and that's what Warren Buffett says. He's, you know, whenever you're picking a stock, just imagine that the stock market closes down for the next 5 years, for the next 10 years. So, like, you're actually buying into a company. You're not buying into a company today and hoping to sell out next week or next month. Like you're looking at the fundamentals of the company, you're looking at growth prospects, you're looking at trends in the economy, and yeah, that's, yeah, never kind of get into something if you think you're going to get out in a week or a month.
It has to be long term.
Yeah.
You've probably seen this though with property bridges. Like, what do you think it is? Why do you think people, especially people in Ireland, I think, don't actively engage more in their finances?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think the first thing to mention is I think there's 150 billion sitting in bank accounts at the minute
in Ireland.
In Ireland, yeah,
150 billion.
Yeah. So I think on a European wide basis, it's trillions sitting just in bank accounts. So that's dormant money.
Sitting as cash, in current accounts, savings accounts, whatever.
Sitting as cash, not doing anything. And, Charlie Munger, the famous investor, he would say, show me the incentive and I'll show you the behavior.
Oh, I love that phrase. It's one of my, I use, yeah. I repeat myself on it all the time because I try make myself think about it.
Yeah.
And I try have incentives that I'm kind of almost forced to do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think tax is a big thing. I think tax on investment is penal at the minute.
Yeah.
So you're capital gains tax 33%, going right up to 50% if it's income tax. So the incentive for people to invest just isn't there. So I think it's number one. I think culturally as well. I think people are used to, or people like the safety of a bank, a deposit account, getting a couple of percent. People don't like taking the risk. And I also think there's a lack of options out there. Like if you look at the Irish stock market at the moment, a lot of Irish companies are delisting on the Irish Stock Exchange. And so there'll be a lack of options. And as you say, accessibility. So, if you're in the old world, if you're with AB and if you're trying to set up a stockbroking account, a number of years ago, that would have been difficult. But I think the younger generation now are kind of getting used to Giro, trading 212, Revolut. So if you're banking on Revolut, you can just click a button, you can invest in the stock market, quite simply.
That's what I literally said to people. I was like, look, let's just use Revolut for the first month or two to keep it simple.
Yeah.
It couldn't be easier.
Yeah.
It really couldn't. For good or for bad, it really couldn't be easier.
Yeah,
it's really interesting the way you break it down there. Is it that we don't have a culture of investing as well? We're a relatively new country in essence in terms of having a bit of money. Ireland was piss poor until the 80s, 90s, 90s really. So there probably isn't that generational wealth when you think about it.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. It depends what, it also depends on the demographic you're looking at. I think there's 150 billion sitting in bank accounts. I'd like to know, what the age of those people are that are sitting on most 150 million. I definitely think the investing depends on your situation. So if you're, if you're a young guy or girl, you're trying to get in the property ladder and you've got a few grand in the bank and you're trying to scrape together a deposit, 50 grand, 70 grand to get in the property ladder, you're going to make speculative investments because making 5%, 10% on your money a year, you're looking at it going, it's going to take me 20 years to get a deposit together. I think if you're sitting on a few million, and this is kind of what we've learned since we set up Property Bridges, if you're sitting on a few million or whatever it is, getting 8%, 9%, 10% on your money with a good degree of certainty and protecting the downside risk by holding security over the property, that's a great return for people. So it just all depends on your situation.
It is funny, isn't it? It's the incentives thing, isn't it? Why is there so much cash? Why is there so much cash sitting there?
I think there was a lot more cash after COVID. I don't know why the, I don't know what the reserves were pre-COVID, but certainly since COVID, the amount of money sitting on deposit has spiked massively.
People stopped spending? Are people scared?
I think it's cultural as well. I think, like, I was at a conference, a crowdfunding conference last week in Brussels, and a guy I was chatting to said that I think the average Italian might save 25% of their wages, where the average American will only save 3% of their wages, but there might be a portion of their wages that they'll invest as well. But I think a large part of it is cultural.
That's really interesting. Actually, I was in Spain last weekend. I was in down in Marbella, like, in the money down there. It's just, and I actually went down that rabbit hole in my head going, where has all this money come from?
Yeah.
Mainly drugs, probably, in Marbella. But yeah, when you look at the generational wealth, I joke, but it's serious. Yeah. Like, when you look at the generational wealth as well, like, a huge mix of cultures. So Italians, Scandinavians is huge down there. You can see it was generational.
Yeah.
You can just tell, like, you have the mum and the dad who are in their 60s, 70s, like, they've got the rich person tan.
It's old money.
Yeah, it's older money. And then you've got the younger generation coming through. But culturally, it's there. You can see that that's instilled in them. Like, so how do we change that? How do we change that in Ireland if people are listening? Like, what do we need to do?
I think financial education. I think, you know, nowadays it's so easy to go on to YouTube or to read a book and to educate yourself in the financial markets. I think there's a lot of noise in the sector as well. Mm. So I think you need to critically think about it as well. Like, there's a lot of people, you know, trying to sell you the dream of, you know, get rich quick.
That's the issue, isn't it? It kind of attracts these bogeymen of, like, people are so terrified of being scams because it does attract kind of shiny characters, isn't it? Like,
yeah, but like, I would encourage people to invest, because that's how you learn. So, you know, if you're in your 20s, like, you know, open a trading account, like, buy a few stocks, like, learn about it, like, invest what you're prepared to lose. But at least when you're in the game, you're learning.
Yeah.
But I do think something needs to be done with the tax rate. I think it's far too penal.
I don't sell because I don't want to deal with it.
Yeah,
if I'm honest.
Yeah,
because I think, why am I investing if I'm then going to try sell out? Then try, like, it's too much to think about.
Yeah,
so I just invest. I don't think about selling to, even if I think there's a better opportunity. I just don't think about selling because I don't want to have to deal with all that.
Yeah, but there's a new, I think the government have brought out a rule that if you own an ETF for 8 years, you have to automatically sell, or you're automatically taxed on your holding. So
that's insane.
It disincentivizes long-term investing.
Stuff like that, you just kind of go, why?
Yeah, I think we're a mature enough country now. We've got, for the first time, the country, like, has money. The citizens, like, have money. Like, if you look at America, I think the capital gains tax in America, I think you've got a 50 grand kind of threshold, and then over 50 grand you pay 15% capital gains.
Okay.
And then over 500 grand you pay 20% capital gains. I think the threshold in Ireland's something like 1300 quid. Like,
What do you sell?
Like, you know, what are you going to do?
Sell a good laptop.
Yeah.
And more than that.
And like, places like Singapore, you know, there's no tax. So, you know, there's a peer-to-peer company we know in Singapore that would have started kind of after us, and they're absolutely flying. So a lot of their citizens, it's just cultural, and also it's incentivized to invest as well. So, you know, we struggle with that. So I think it's all.
Are we at risk of people leaving? Because, like, people are far more mobile after COVID.
Mm.
Like, when I look around the streets, now we talked about Dublin and we'll talk about it again in a couple of minutes, but there's not a lot of young faces. It's something I've noticed in the last, like, 6 months. Like, obviously the colleges are back now, so you've got the kind of, like, people from 18 to 22. Say from 22 to 35, I'm not seeing many of those knocking around. And anecdotally, you're kind of hearing of people, like, moving to Dubai, moving to Australia. It's like the old days of, like, going to London, going to America, like the old cliche days of, like, going abroad to make it. But, like, are we at risk of people, like, another brain drain?
I think, I'm not sure. I don't know. Like I went to my 20s for a few years, you know, lots of my friends did. Like, we all came back. Mm. I think that's been in the mindset for a long time. But I think there's still a lot of opportunities here, like more so than there's ever been. Okay. You know, you've got a lot of good employment here, a lot of good jobs. Like, you know, we see it when we're going out to try and find good young people to join the company. Like, it can be hard to get, you know, young kind of Irish talent to join like a small startup because they're off trying to get jobs with the Facebooks, the Googles, the Amazons.
Is that a problem? You're not the first entrepreneur to bring that up.
I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I think when I was young, that's what I would have been doing. Like, you want to work for a good brand. Like, it is good for your career if you've spent a couple of years in a brand that people recognize.
But is that a problem for people like you, like founders who are early enough stage that might not have the capital, brand equity? Like, are you struggling to get talent?
I think that I wouldn't say we're struggling to get talent. There's talent out there. There is talent out there. It's just, yeah, like we're out in Sandyford at the minute, so, and we're maybe looking at taking on a few people. So we are looking at, well, if we're in town, would it be easier to attract talent?
I didn't want to slander Sandyford there, but it's grim enough.
So Sandyford's been good to us, but yeah, we're looking at things like that, making the office a nicer environment, spending a few quid in the office.
Well, if you're going to have to come in, people do want it to be nice now.
Exactly.
We've kind of got spoiled. Yeah. Like, we do kind of want like the bells and whistles now.
Yeah.
I've chatted to a lot of founders and they're all saying that. They're like, yeah, look, we're going to stay hybrid, obviously. But when we want people to come in, we do realize we have to like step it up now.
Yeah.
Because they are competing with the multinationals.
Yeah. Big time. Yeah. Like, it's funny, when I was working in my last startup, it was the guy that set it up was from an investment bank. So he's still old school, kind of at the desk, 7 a.m. working to 6 o'clock, and at the time I joined, it was all kind of analysts in the company, so all from financial backgrounds. Then at the point, we tried to hire software developers. Trying to get a software developer to come in at 7 was just like it was impossible. So the people who come in say, like, I can get a job at Google, start at 9, freelance, you know, out door at 5. Yeah. Like, why would I
bother? On crazy money? Yeah. Like, you have to be offering more than money.
Yeah, so that was a funny thing. Like, that was the culture in that organization changed, because you can't ask some people to come in at 7, other people to come in at 9, and away you go. And I think, you know, it's a shift, right? There's a shift happened after COVID that you wouldn't have dreamt of, like 2 or 3 days in the office a week, whereas now it's the norm.
This is something I want to unpack with you, right? Because I can't believe none of people are talking about this.
Yeah.
Like, we've had such a shift, but I'm now starting to hear from people going, no, no, we're back in the office now, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. I'm like, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Good luck with that. Yeah. Because it's almost like a fear has set in that they're like, we need to go back to what we were doing.
Yeah.
That somehow the economic winds have changed because they're not in the office 5 days a week. Like, how do you see it? Like, how do you see it playing out in the next couple of years?
Well, for us, like, hybrid works for us. Like, but we're a small enough company that, you know, I know what each member of my team are doing on a daily basis because we're working so close. I think it might be different in a larger organization where, you know, like, people, you might not know what your staff are doing on a daily basis. So it depends, and it also depends what industry you're in. Like, Elon Musk talks about it as well. Like, he thinks, like, hybrid work is a luxury. He thinks it's unfair, you know, if people are cleaning or people are working in manufacturing, that they're in 5 days a week.
But life's not fair.
Well,
do you know, exactly, you can't. I think Elon's cracker, there's cheese that slipped off his cracker a little bit. Like, I read that biography book. Like, it's wild stuff.
Yeah. And then you hear about Amazon that, well, a lot of these tech companies are asking people to come in or forcing people to come in 5 days a week. And the reason why they're doing that is that they want people to, you know, quit, essentially. So they want to lower their staff numbers. They're unprepared to give out redundancies, and that they want people to voluntarily leave. So
it's horrible, really. Like, it's such a shady way to operate.
You don't know what's happening. You don't know. Yeah. But for us, it worked for us. Going for 5 days a week, going back to 5 days a week, I don't think we get any benefit to it at all.
And just won't get people to do it, I think. I think people are delusional if they think that you can get really talented people, because people's lives have fundamentally changed. People live different now.
Yeah.
I was talking to someone yesterday, they live out beside me, and they were talking about moving jobs. And they were saying, oh, my commute would be 90 minutes in the morning, 90 minutes in the evening. I was like,
yeah.
Are you demented? Like,
I could
add it up over the week.
I couldn't.
That's 2 days commute in a week. I'm like, that's mental.
Yeah, I couldn't stick that. I couldn't
your life,
stick it. Yeah.
Like, and people used to do it because we had no choice, and that's how we thought things were.
But it's just wasted time.
It's just 90 minutes time. A day each way.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Not, like, someone like that's going to be much more productive in the office.
Much happier as well doing the hybrid thing.
Much more productive at home.
But doing the hybrid thing, even if you're in a couple of days a week, okay, I can kind of stomach that.
Yeah.
But 5 days a week, 90 minutes each way, not for all the tea in China, like not for whatever the salary is, it wouldn't be worth it. You'd probably do it for 2 years and then burn out.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. Like, when I look back at, like, whenever I was working for the investment bank, I was at my desk for 6:30 in the morning, like every day. And because you're trading, on the markets, like, you're barely allowed to get out for lunch in case something happens over lunchtime.
So what would your day would be like? So what time are you up? You're up at like 5.
Yeah, you're up at 5. This is in London, so you're up at 5.
And at the desk for 6:30.
Quick, you know, shower, change, breakfast on the tube, at the desk for 6:30.
And then you're working until what time?
Working at about 5, 5:30.
Get home, something to eat, bed. Rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
That's definitely something you can only do for a period of time. How long were you doing that for?
So I was doing that for a few years. So that was at one company's 6:30, but those other trading jobs I had, maybe starting at 7. So it wasn't much. Like, I didn't really like the work environment. Like, I like going out, meeting people, you know, building a business, starting relationships. When you're trading, you're just looking at a computer screen. Mm. You're not meeting anyone.
Yeah.
Like on week to week, month to month. Like, there's no conversations, meetings. You're not meeting any clients.
You're a human AI, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just making decisions.
Yeah. So that was part of the job that, you know, I'm glad I'm out of it now.
So where did the spark for Property Bridges come from?
So during my time in banking, really, I kind of got disillusioned with the system, so to speak. You know, I thought it was inefficient. So my role as a trader, I think in this day and age with a lot of technology, direct market access, there's you're not really creating much value in the job that I was doing and the part of the bank that I was working in. And we were servicing, you know, large pension funds, hedge funds in the UK. And, we're making a lot of fees, and the bank was making a lot of fees for doing that. So I thought it was highly inefficient. I thought the industry was highly opaque. And, whenever peer-to-peer lending came along, whenever I saw it evolve in the UK, I thought, you know, this is brilliant. It's so direct, so transparent. There's, you know, very few layers of intermediation between the lender and the borrower.
Break it down simply for anyone who has no idea what peer-to-peer lending is.
Mm. Peer-to-peer lending is just lending to, you know, another individual or company traditionally via the internet. So it's without the need of a traditional intermediary like a bank. So, you know, the old way of doing things was you have your money in deposit with the bank. You know, the bank can lend out your money. So that's how peer-to-peer started, really. Like, one of the first peer-to-peer companies in the UK was Zopa. So the people that set up Zopa were very frustrated that when your money's on deposit at the bank, you might be earning 2% interest on your savings. When you try and get a loan, you're being charged 10-12%. So they're like, well, listen, if, like, now we have the internet, if we set up a platform and people can lend to each other, it'll be much more efficient and we can take a small margin in the middle. It'll be a much kind of fair way of doing things. ironically, they started as a peer-to-peer and now they've got their banking license.
No way.
So they're back to banking, yeah. But that's how the industry started. So Zopa was, they were primarily, I think they were only personal loans. So you could invest and you could lend to other individuals. Then the market evolved into lending to SMEs. So there's a big company in the UK called Funding Circle.
I've heard of them, yeah.
So you could lend to a small business. So like if you had a favourite donut shop and they were expanding, they're opening another donut shop but couldn't get money from the bank, you could potentially get money from a peer-to-peer lender.
So you'd say, right, look, we're hoping to open up a donut shop in Galway. We're looking to raise 50K. You'd put it up on Funding Circle. And then your like customers and public yeah. could buy in for like a set period of time and then get a return. Is that how it would work?
Yeah, on the company lending, it's typically 3 years. So you've got Linked Finance in Ireland do the SME lending. So typically 3 years, there's an interest rate involved. So, you know, you might be getting paid 9-10%. That's typically paid monthly on the company model. The model that we do is property backed. So,
what was your original idea?
Yeah, well, that was it. So it was I saw the peer to peer market evolving. So firstly, it was personal loans. Then it was loans to companies that were typically unsecured.
Yeah,
and then it evolved into property lending. So what attracted me about property lending was you had the underlying security. So whenever we give out a loan, we always take first legal charge over the property. So we're protecting any downside risk.
Who owns the property?
So the borrower will own the property, but just like a mortgage, you know, the bank has a charge on your property. So we're only regulated to lend to companies. So we're dealing with like home builders around Ireland.
Right.
So we don't call them developers anymore.
Home builders just so cuddly and warm. I love it.
Yeah, it certainly is. So there's a negative connotation.
There really is. And again, it's like the crypto thing, the finance thing. There shouldn't be like, but there just is in Ireland. There's this hangover from, justly in some cases, there's kind of a hangover from it. But in most cases, like, everyone's just trying to do something decent. Everyone's trying to build something decent.
Yeah, like I think it's misguided now. So like the borrowers that we deal with are completely different from, developers from the Celtic Tiger. And in fact, like I think a lot of the developers from the Celtic Tiger era just aren't in home building anymore. They've kind of moved on to other sectors, could be building data centers or renewable projects, or as we saw on the recent prime time, they're in the emergency accommodation sector. Like home building now is, you know, it's a tough enough gig. Like the margins, I know the house prices are quite expensive, and often the narrative peddled by the media is that, you know, the greedy developers like making a fortune, but like we've been lending now for 6 years, and the margin on home building is quite tight.
So you'll back, like, will you back like an estate or like an office block or like an apartment block? What is it that you would back? So if we go on to like Property Bridges today, like what are we backing?
Yeah, so it's mainly residential construction. So we get approached by small to medium sized developers, home builders across the country, and come to us. They'll say, I have 10 units down in, you know, County Laois. I need whatever, 3 million to build these houses, kind of get a loan. So we'll obviously, like, we'll assess it. We make sure that it's got enough profit margin. So we'll typically look for 15% profit margin. We'll assess the cost of the build. You know, we'll assess the type of build. We'll look at the borrower's background, his track record. We go through a whole series of like assessments. Then we'd issue a term sheet. And then if that's accepted, then we'd go through a full series of due diligence. So we get a QS involved. We get a lawyer, our lawyers involved. We get an independent valuation.
serious work to it. Like,
yeah, it's a very active form of lending. Mm. It's and even when the loan is approved, it's funded in stages and it's funded in arrears. So it's not a case of I want 3 million, we deposit 3 million in the bank account, away you go. It's
right.
It's more that you agree to a construction program, so they could be drawing down 250 grand a month. So they go off, do the work with their own money. So we're paying in arrears.
Okay, right, I get you. So you're protecting kind of all sides really there.
Yeah. So we're taking security of the property. Then they go off, they'll do a month's work. They'll send us a drawdown report. They'll say, listen, I've spent 250 grand this month. I need a drawdown. So we'll send out our QS. So our QS will inspect the work that's done. They'll make sure that it's been built to regulation, make sure it's been built to planning. We'll go through the planning conditions. And then if it's, we look at that report, and if it's approved, then we'll release the money then.
Oh.
So there's a lot of safety nets built into the process. But like with anything, you know, we're paying investors like 8-9% per annum. So when you're getting 8 or 9%, like there's risk involved.
Yeah.
And we put that all over the website. Like it's, you know, you're taking risk. Like we think the risk is managed. We do the best we can to manage the risk, but.
Well, when you see the layer levels of checks there, like you see the hands-on levels of checks, and Irish people still do have an affinity for property. Like we still do love it. Like we do have a passion for it. Like there's something deep within us. Like you just.
I don't know what it is, yeah, about the psyche, but there's definitely love for property. Mm. And that was one of the other reasons why I set up Property Bridges. For a lot of people, it can be hard to access. So
yeah, well, it's inaccessible for most people, being honest. Yeah. I love watching the UK, you know, like those flip programs in the UK. They buy a house at auction for 50 grand and then they have 6 months to turn around. I'm addicted to them. Like I grew up watching them. I was a weird kid, grew up watching them. Even through college, I'd be watching them every day. Like I was just fascinated. Whereas here, there isn't really that opportunity for people to get a start, like to trade their way up the property ladder.
It's very difficult. It's a game that's very difficult to get into now.
It seems non-existent now.
Yeah. And whenever we go out and meet our borrowers, like they're typically like they're not young. Like that's one of the fears I have for the industry, like both in terms of, you know, home builders or like even people coming into the fix and flip market. It's really difficult to grind out like a profit in it, especially if you're a newcomer.
Mm.
And as well, like even on the sites, there's not a lot of young people getting into it. Like there's not a lot of young people want to spend cold winter's morning like bricklaying, you know. And then, you know, you might be building a site in Leash today, then you build like 10 houses, then your next project, you know, is an RWS or so it's
hard to make the numbers work. Like people do think it's a, you know, it's millions per, it's not really, like the margins aren't there. When I started like studying like how like developments get built, and there's all the council contributions, and you have to build the roads, you have to build the storage, and there's so much. Yeah. Like the housing crisis is just talked about so much in Ireland, and very few people put forward kind of rationale. So I was looking forward to having you on to kind of chat about it in more detail to kind of like understand it a bit, because there's so much emotion.
Mm.
So why is there such a gap between demand and supply?
So I think it goes back to like after the global financial crisis, we from 2008 to 2018, we didn't really build anything. Like we built 90,000 units in 2007, I think. And then for those 10 years, I think we might have been building 5,000 units a year.
Mm.
And at the same time, population is going up. And now the population is going up like at a pretty accelerated rate. So it's just not enough. There's not enough stock. And then it's,
so we're struggling with that gap of 10 years. Is that where the deficit has come from?
Yeah. And so we're struggling with that gap. And, you know, even if we build 50,000 units a year, which it's hard to get up to that because it's not like a tap. It's it can take years to get through planning. So there's a lot of friction built into the system. It's not something you can turn on quickly. Then you need the labor as well. And it's difficult. It's a difficult kind of industry to get into, and it's, you know, you just can't turn on the tap overnight.
So what's the solution? Is there a solution?
Yeah, well, there's a few different solutions, a few like radical solutions as well.
They're the best kind. They're often the ones that work. I have a specific question I want to ask you after this, but hit me with your radical first.
I think they should completely remove VAT from new build homes. Like if you go to Northern Ireland, you go to other parts of the UK, there's no VAT on new builds. So like if you go north of the border, like my brother bought a house not too long ago, nice kind of three bed semi for 130 grand.
Wow.
You know, you couldn't buy a shed.
Couldn't even imagine that.
Like. Yeah. So like VAT's like one thing. We've got, you know, very high regulations, very high standards when it comes to building. You've got expense built into the planning process because it takes so long. You've other things like Irish water were like very expensive as well for some buyers. Now there's a levy at the minute. So the government have recognised that and have...
So what are all the extra costs that go into like having building a house? Like what are the other stuff before even laying a brick in the ground? What are the other stuff? There's break it down for people and for me that wouldn't kind of understand this. Like you talked about Irish water. What else is there?
Yeah, well, you have to buy the land. Then you've got stamp duty. Then you have planning fees. You take through planning. Then that, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty built into that. That can take years. Like I was speaking to a developer a couple of weeks ago. So he went for planning. I think it then went into the board. So even if you get your planning like granted by the local authority, someone appeals it, it can go to the board. So he was in on board Planola for 77 weeks. And then it got rejected because it didn't have enough green space. So he's trying to build 24 apartments. Didn't have enough green space, so he had to reduce the size of the apartments. So it's gone from 24 to 18. So he had to completely redo a new planning application from scratch, submit it again.
So you're starting back from...
And you're back at square one. But then when you get planning, so you've got the professional fees, you need architects, engineers, you know, there's a ream of consultants that you have to get now on residential construction. You've got the core construction costs, you've got the, you know, the materials, you've got labour, you've got site development costs, then you've got development levies.
What are they? Because I've heard of them, but I don't really fully understand what they are.
Yeah, so you're paying the local authority for, you know, kind of roads and access and services and lighting, things like that. Then you've got VAT. So on top of everything, you've got 13.5% on the build. So, and the Irish water fees were, you know, you're talking $6,000 to get an Irish water connection. Now, as I mentioned, there's a waiver at the minute, but up until kind of last year, it was costing an extra $6,000 to connect to Irish water. So like in the continent, I think the average connection cost is £500. But for an Irish water connection,
six grand. Per property.
So everything adds up.
That's before you even start marketing it, starting getting it done. So hit me with your radical solution. What's the answer here?
I think the government need to remove VAT. You know, it's a quick win. I think the government are playing around the edges at the minute. So the government are trying to do their best. Like they have, you know, they set up the LDA. They've set up the HBFI to fund home builders as well. You know, they've provided an incentive scheme for first-time buyers. But the incentive schemes is very much kind of bridging the affordability gap. So it's not bringing the price down.
Mm.
So the best thing the government have done in the last 6 years, from our point of view, is providing the levy waiver for both Irish water and development levies. So that's been waived.
Right.
So that has really accelerated delivery houses. So a lot of the schemes we look at like won't be viable. So we're looking at schemes that make like 15% profit, a couple of years ago, we were looking at schemes that they weren't making that. So we're not going to fund it.
Right.
So viability is a big problem. So the most radical solution that I can see and the quickest solution is just remove VAT. Politically, I think that would be unpopular.
People are so touchy. Yeah. Like, people are so afraid to pull that thread. You see with the hospitality there in the last budget, like, they wouldn't drop it from 13 to 9. So I think removing it, they're just not going to pull that. Like, even if they know long-term, it would benefit.
Yeah.
It goes back to our very first point about being able to see the long term, being able to kind of like delay gratification for 10 years, going, if we remove that now, okay, there'd be a small hit, but in 10 years' time, we'll have caught back up to the demand we need.
Yeah. It also reduces cost, you know. So instead of, you know, the government are paying for these incentive schemes to help people, you know, like buy houses at the current market rate, but You've still got a big mortgage. If you're taking VAT off, like, you know, you're reducing costs for first time buyers. Mm. So I think, yeah, I think that needs to be done. Like, the need to stimulate, you know, private development. Like, there's a lot of like social good comes from private development as well. Like, I mentioned the VAT, but there's a lot of other like fees that, you know, planning fees, levies that the government get out of private housing. And then, you know, as well as that, you've got part five. So for every new scheme of 10 units, there should be two part five schemes as part of the planning
permission. What's that mean?
So part five means that you're giving the house to the local council at cost. So if you're building 10 houses, two of the units is going to the council at cost. So you have to make your profit in the first eight units. So there is social elements built into private housing, and I think we should be stimulating that a lot more. You know, the government are doing their best. They've set up the LDA to try and, you know, build like social housing on government land, which is good as well. But the government are increasingly competing with the private market when I think they should be incentivizing the private market.
It makes more sense, right, to go with the people that already know what they're doing and just become a part of it. Why is Dublin so flat? This is my bugbear. This is where I thought you were going to get radical. I was like, please say build like 30 stories, because it drives me bonkers.
You travel
to, like, I was in Madrid last week, and like, you're just kind of looking at it going, lads, like, you could house thousands of people on one block if you just built
it makes no sense. Like, Dublin should be building skyscrapers all over Dublin, and it really frustrates me that
it's the NIMBYs of, like, oh, protect Victorian Dublin. Yeah, we're not talking about knocking down, like, Victorian. We're not knocking Merrion Square here.
Keep the Georgian Quarter, but out near the docks, just build.
It's so backward. Yeah. It drives me absolutely mental. You go to Manchester, go over to Manchester a lot for the football. Like, that's a perfect example of an industrial city who's kept its heartland, embraced it, made it better, turned all the warehouses into these incredible apartments. But they're building these giant, like, mini cities. And people go on about, like, we talked about earlier, but Dublin's dead.
Yeah.
It's on its knees in terms of, like, people aren't coming into the city anymore. Yeah, because they can't live here.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Because they can't live in the city centre. City centre is dead because you've got, like, two floors, first floor retail, second floor probably not even can't be used anymore because of fire regs.
Yeah.
So what do you expect?
Exactly. Yeah. No, the city's dead. It's not dense enough. So they need to build up in the city. Like, we're, as I said, like, we've got an office out in Sandyford, and they're throwing apartments up out in Sandyford, and it's good to see, but
it is.
You know,
but there's
build houses
can't
in the suburbs
build
apartments.
It's still the way around. We're doing it the wrong way. We're doing it the other way. We're building apartments where you can, but you can't just have apartments after apartments after apartments. You go to places like Malaga or Madrid, like, the facility for people living in apartments are unreal.
Yeah.
Because they've been doing it for decades.
Yeah.
They know people need, like, proper creches, proper parks. There's green areas everywhere.
Yeah.
There's playgrounds everywhere. My daughter was in her element. We couldn't walk like three blocks or in a new playground. Class.
Yeah. And
it just frustrates me, like, because it's not rocket science.
Yeah. It goes back to the co-living as well. So, like, co-living was, you know, it was a very positive thing for the market, and like, we talked to an investor that was trying to bring a co-living scheme through the planning process in Kenilworth Square. And there must have been the planning process for a few years, and they were fighting with residents to try and get this co-living scheme through. So they're at it like a few years, and just before the final planning got granted for the co-living scheme, the government came out and said, okay, like, you know, we're banning this. Like, we're banning this completely. So then they'd go back into the planning system to go for apartments. And then by the time they got planning for apartments, you know, inflation was through the roof. Planning wasn't really viable. So, you know, this investor came in, an international investor came in, must have spent 5 years in the project. In the end, I think they just sold the site, took a loss on it. I don't know if those apartments were even built.
Surely it costs a fortune just to carry that. I always often look at these sites, and I'm kind of like watching stuff get developed or not. And always in the back of my head, I'm kind of going, how much is it costing them to have that there every month, every year?
Yeah.
Just even a carry cost of just having loans on it.
Yeah, well, if the site's bought with debt, it's gonna be costing you money just to, like, every week. You know, a lot of sites could be bought with equity. So you're waiting for that uplift if and when you get planning.
Right. But if you don't get it. Yeah, it's worrying. It is worrying. So let's talk about good things. What are you seeing in the market with property bridges that gets you excited?
What are we seeing? Well, you know, there's a lot more units getting developed. So whenever we got into the game in 2018, I think we were building about 20,000 units a year. We're now up to, you know, 35,000, 40,000 units per year. So that's a positive thing. You know, we're attracting more international investment as well. So, like, from a property bridges point of view, you know, we've developed a track record. So we built a retail platform, developed a track record with retail investors, and now we're attracting some international institutional investment for the platform. And then as an industry, we just became regulated last year with the central bank. So peer-to-peer lending, crowdfunding has become regulated now across the European Union.
So what does that mean?
As a whole. So, well, it means that, I guess it's a stamp of approval from central bank that, you know, we're following the regulations, that we're running the company correctly, that we, you know, we've got a capital reserve requirement as well, so we're more robust as a company. We've had to hire a couple of people in the company, so we've had to hire kind of an independent director to make sure that, you know, we're following the compliance and everything else. So I think investors should have more confidence in the company. But because it's European wide regulation, that means we can expand a lot more easily.
Okay.
So we're looking at going international.
Amazing. What's on the horizon? Can you reveal?
Well, we've got a market discovery grant from Enterprise Ireland, which is a massive help to us. And we're looking at entering the Portuguese market.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Doesn't hurt that that's going to be your place of having to go down to Portugal every now and again.
It's a
strategic bit of lifestyle design there.
Yeah.
That's cool. So if people are looking to get involved in property bridges now, like, what can they do? Like, give us an idiot's guide to get involved here.
It's very simple. Just go on to the website, sign up. There's a onboarding process when you sign up, and you can invest from €500.
Okay. So it's very achievable. Then.
Yeah, it's really, very accessible. Really accessible, yeah. Yeah.
And what kind of stuff can they, like, back then?
So small developments. So residential schemes of anything from 2 units to 20 units.
And they can pick which one, do they? Can they pick which one?
Yeah, so it's all loan by loan. So it's not a portfolio basis.
Oh, cool. So you can kind of, like, you can go, oh, okay, I'd like to back this in this project here.
Yeah, so you sign up. We put all the information on the website, so it's very transparent. So we would write a credit paper for each loan, so investors can read about, you know, what the project is, what the borrower's background is, you know, what the exit plan is, and things like that. So people can, like, fully assess the scheme before they get into it. So, like, the development loans, we also provide, you know, there's some fix and flips up there as well. So people that are buying properties, renovating it, you know, renting it out, then they're refinancing with a mainstream bank.
Okay.
We provide some bridging finance. We've funded, you know, some offices as well. So acquisition finance to purchase an office, get it leased, get it refinanced. But our bread and butter, about 80% of our funding does go into residential construction. So we, you know, we're focused on the construction side of things to try and alleviate the housing crisis in some sense. And that's what our lenders love as well. Mm. So like our lenders very much seem to be interested in, you know, getting a return, but also providing a social good as well. So, you know, I think we've funded close to 1,000 units since we've started.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's chunky. Like that makes a real difference. Like that makes a real impact.
Yeah. So on like a wider scheme, it's, you know, it's a drop in the ocean, but for us, like starting from standing start, you know, it's huge.
So, what's your goal?
Well, like our goal is really to, well, it's a modest enough goal to generate wealth for, you know, the people that invest with us, but also to provide, you know, fair finance to the home builders we deal with as well.
What about you though? What's your own personal goal? What would you love in 5 years if we're sitting down to have another chat? Like, what would you love to have done?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, what we've achieved already is, you know, surpassed where I thought we'd
really
we'd get to on day one. Yeah. Yeah.
So why did you become a founder?
I always had a burning desire to set up my own business. It was always a burning desire. And then peer-to-peer lending just seemed like such a natural fit. Like I worked in the financial markets. I thought peer-to-peer lending was a real fair way to lend money and to generate wealth for people. Like I thought both the lender and the borrower would benefit from the whole arrangement. Whereas when you're, you know, putting your money in the bank, getting the 2%, borrowing from a bank, getting charged 10%. I just thought people, you know, a lot of it was opaque. People didn't, especially with pensions and pension funds, like it frustrated me a bit when you were signed up to a pension and you didn't know, like you didn't know where you were investing. There's some hedge fund manager in London investing your money, you didn't know where it was.
It's a shocker. Like it's on my list. I have these things. I have a blockages list. Yeah. I work through them every so often. And that's next up.
Yeah.
Oh, my bloody hell. Like,
so what, like
a shocker.
I have a pension in Dublin now and it's, I literally log into, like I log into the platforms, like literally one number on the screen. Like this is what your pension's worth. Now if I want to change what I'm invested in, I have to send a bloody carrier pigeon in the office to change what I'm invested in. Whereas with us, you know, you're logging in, you've got a dashboard, you see what you're investing in, you choose what you're investing in. You know, it's a lot more modern. Okay, mm-hmm. we want to keep driving that. Like we want to create an app and we want to, you know, continually invest in the technology. But for the most part, you know, it's a massive improvement on, you know, some of the other investments that are out there.
I believe you have to be the CEO of your own life. Like if you don't choose your direction, someone else will choose it for you. Pension's a perfect example. If you go, throw it in there and don't think about it at 65, it's insanity. Like, and it's the same with everything. I always say that about health. I say it about your business, you know, anything you want to achieve in life, you have to be engaged. Mm. Otherwise, you're just a passenger. You're just in this bus. Wherever it goes is fine. Like with no destination, there's no plan. Like you have to be more engaged. And especially nowadays, there's no reason not to be. Like it's the psychology piece though. It's just trying to unlock that bit of self-awareness to go, right, just get over the fear, educate myself, like read the psychology of money, read Atomic Habits, read things like that to go, okay, I'm just wired. This is my wiring of why I'm afraid of this stuff. And yeah, it's not to be afraid of. Like,
yeah,
what's worse to be afraid of is to get to 65 and you're like, oh shit,
yeah,
this isn't where I thought we'd be.
I think it is coming with the younger generation. Like it was cultural, sure. Like in our parents' generation, you would go to the local financial advisor, you know, you would invest in whatever the scheme was at the time. Whereas like our generation, like they are going on to Revolut, they're investing in stocks, or I think they're a bit more financial literate. So I think there's a massive kind of trend towards kind of direct investing as opposed to going through like an advisor or a broker.
Before we get to the quick fire round, if someone's like listening to this now, they're like, right, okay, the lads are right. I'm going to get a bit more kind of hands on here. Apart from going to property bridges, what other resources do you think are useful? Be they books or be they like whatever. What else would you advise people to have a look at? If you're trying to get a bit more savvy, like what resources do you use?
Just in terms of, like, so just to become more financially literate?
Yeah, just to become a bit more kind of like tuned into what's going on. Where would you advise them to go?
I think you could start maybe with the likes of CNBC or Bloomberg. Start learning about the financial markets. Start learning about how things are connected, like how the world works, how geopolitics can affect like the oil price, you know, why a stock might go up or down. But I think it's important to, you know, listen to the really, because we were saying like there's, you know, there's a lot of noise out there as well. So, you know, look at the really successful investors like the Warren Buffetts, the Ray Dalios, to look at what they're saying. But I think with investment, you have to do it yourself as well. So I'd encourage people, like I set up an online trading account like in college, I think, and, you know, invest in a few stocks, lost a lot of money, kind of learned a bit more about it. And it's only through doing that, that you gain knowledge from it.
100%. Couldn't agree more. You just get involved. And even like the thing I'm doing, like it's not massive money, like, but over the course of the year, like I did a coffee to crypto thing during COVID. I was like, right, what'll I do? Well, I'll substitute buying my morning coffee for putting it into crypto. It was just a bit of fun.
Yeah.
But like at the end of the year, a couple of grand, just purely from compounding and just putting it in every day and just being engaged. And I learned more in a year than I would have ever just like reading blogs. Like I agree with you 100%. No skin in the game. No action, no learning.
Yeah.
Right, quick fire round. What book would you recommend every entrepreneur or investor read?
Yeah, Shoe Dog. What everyone says, I think Shoe Dog. Shoe Dog.
I should be on commission from Phil Knight. I should be a Nike-sponsored athlete at this day.
Shoe Dog is the best business book I've read. It's brilliant, but listen, everyone says Shoe Dog. So I was reading an interesting book recently on called The Price of Time, which
I've heard of that.
Goes through interest rates from Babylonian times to present day, and it discusses
the
price of time.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
What's something you have to learn the hard way?
I think I'm not sure on this. You've stumped me here. I know
it's probably too many to pick. People are always like, oh, that's so much.
Yeah.
Where do I even start?
Yeah. And there's, to a certain extent, like sometimes you have to learn the hard way as well. Like if it was easy, you know, everyone would be doing it. Like if you learn a hard lesson, you're gonna remember it.
It's like we said about the action. If you don't do the investments, you're never really gonna learn. Like you're not just gonna read about a Tesla stock and go, oh, I understand now, whereas if you've lost or you've gained. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what you learn the hard way is just to be involved. Get involved. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
Yeah, get like the normal stuff that other people say, you know, you're sacrificing like a bit of fun, few holidays, like time your friends. At the time I set up the business, I didn't see it as a sacrifice. Like I had a lot of fun in my 20s and it's kind of coming towards my mid-30s. So, you know, I didn't see it as a sacrifice. Like I told you that for the NDRC program, like I packed the bags, moved to Waterford, like relocated to Waterford for 3 months and just gave it 100% to launch the business. But the time I embraced it, I didn't see it as a sacrifice.
I like that. I like that attitude of just go all in. Yeah. Just embrace it and for good or for bad, see it as an opportunity.
Hopefully, you're listening to the pod and you're feeling inspired. Maybe you want to do new things in your own business, or maybe you have that brilliant idea you've always wanted to bring a little bit further and see if it works. So why not right now? You listen to the majority of the guests on this show, and they've been helped by the local enterprise office at some stage in the journey. They have something for everybody. Whether you have that idea you want to develop, you want to get your products to new markets, you want to innovate your existing products, or you want to expand staff and premises, they have the supports to help. So why not today? If you want to start up or grow your business, then contact your local enterprise office today.
What would you do today if I give you 10 million euro?
It's an easy one for me.
Oh, don't say it. Don't say it. Don't do that to me.
I would invest it alongside the other retail investors in the platform. So like we're like at the minute, like we would, like we're making, like it's a small enough margin gain. So where our investors are getting like 8-9%, we're going to make a small margin like on that. So if we could, like if we had 10 million of our own money, we're investing alongside our investors, we'll be getting a little flywheel going. So that's absolutely what we'll be doing with it.
Fine, I'm going to get you on the next question then. I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can only invest it in one person or one company, not yourself. Who is it?
Yeah. So I thought about this question as well, and I would invest it in some kind of construction technology. Because as I mentioned earlier, like they're getting labor on sites now is very difficult. There's not a lot of young people getting into the construction game. So there's a company called Hardcore Technologies, I think.
Okay.
That recently built the first 3D houses, I think it was in Dundalk a couple of weeks ago.
Cool.
So I think we're definitely going to move towards modular construction, 3D printing.
It's like, really cool. Yeah. When you see, like I fall down the YouTube rabbit hole quite frequently on those, like in the factory in Germany, and they're just making the house. I watch Grand Designs all the time, and it just comes on the truck. And they're like, it's like adult Lego.
Yeah.
Like 2 days to the house up. You're like, that's the future.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. Yeah, the way we're building today, it's not.
It feels a bit archaic.
It's not going to be right.
No, it's like literally brick by brick, breaking their heart, breaking their back.
In the muck and gutters, the depths of winter, like it's not. Yeah, there's better ways to do it.
Modular housing investment. Okay. If you're starting from zero in 2024, what would you do?
Yeah, probably something with less regulation. With me, like with Property Bridges, it's kind of half online, half traditional. I think that's maybe the era that like I was like born in the 80s. Like I'm not like the internet was only a thing whenever, you know, we got into our teens.
Yeah.
So I think something purely software for me, I don't think I could do it. So it'd have to be like a hybrid of, you know, some kind of online business with a bit of tech, bit of innovation. But like something tangible as well, something with a like a real world kind of impact, or you know, a traditional, semi online.
What do you believe that other people will find strange or strongly disagree with?
Yeah, this is a tough one as well. What do I believe that other people would find strange?
There's a million of them in property. Give me a few already.
Yeah, well, like in property, I'll just caveat this firstly by saying
good. That's how I like the answers to start.
That firstly, I think in Ireland we pay way too much tax. Like income tax is a disgrace. Tax of investment, as we've touched on, is disgracefully high. But I do think we should be paying water charges. Like, probably not a popular opinion, but like water is a service. We all benefit from it. Like, you know, like Irish water is underfunded at the minute. Like, hopefully with the Apple money and the new budget, it's going to become like properly funded. But like a lot of the Irish water cost was levied on developers, which was then levied on the first time buyers.
You pay somewhere.
Yeah.
You pay somewhere along the line.
Yeah. Okay. And like we're funding scheme at the minute. where if there's infrastructure that needs to be upgraded, the developer has to fund that out of his own pocket. So where's that going to go? It's going to go onto the price of houses as well. So yeah, so Irish Water, I think water should be taxed. Or
they replaced all the pipes on our road, not last summer, the summer before. I was just chatting to the lads because they had to dig up our house to come in around the back. And I was chatting to them. I was like, well, what's the crack with the pipes? He's like, you would not want to see them.
Yeah.
He's like, the water. He's like, they were rotten. Like half. He's like, probably we reckon more than half the water was just going into the ground. And the rest, the pipes were just riddled.
Yeah.
And like, you're drinking that. So like, that's the one thing I don't have a problem paying for is water.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're paying for an income tax anyway, so you better off just be more transparent. Give people the choice. What's been your worst investment?
Probably trying to beat the market in my 20s, as I've discussed. Trying to like make a quick buck, playing the stock markets. Like, it's pretty much a fool's game. Kind of learned the hard way. But you know, it was good learning. Didn't have a lot of money in my 20s, so I'd rather learn kind of when I'm young.
Time in the market, not timing the market. I always say that to myself.
So definitely trying to play the stock market and come out on top.
What's been your best investment then?
Yeah, 100%. Just investing, taking all my savings, every penny of my savings, and putting it into property bridges.
Starting it up,
yeah. So... you know, I didn't have a lot of savings to go into it, but put it in, launched it in 2018, like raised money, and a few years later, a significant valuation. So without a doubt, yeah, property bridges.
Nice. What's your final piece of advice to every founder or aspiring founder listening?
Yeah, so I don't think I'm qualified to give advice to existing entrepreneurs, but for aspiring entrepreneurs, I would say that, like, there's always an excuse. There's never a right time. You just have to go for it. Especially whenever I took the decision, I didn't have a mortgage, didn't have kids, and I think it's a little bit easier at that stage. But just go for it. If you have an idea and you want to make it happen, you know, don't wait till tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that's the most powerful advice you can kind of ever get or give, because the minute you start thinking, there's a million reasons not to do it.
You talk yourself out of it very easily. Yeah.
You always get that burst of ambition and the burst of energy. And most founders say it to me, like, they're like, if I knew now what I knew then, oh my God. I was like, but you need to not know. Because if you knew, no one would start a business.
You need to be a little bit naive. I think as well.
You need to retain that though. The best founders I meet still have that curiosity.
Yeah.
And still have that naivety. Like, it's kind of a mixture of both. You have to have that.
Yeah.
What's life about? Life's about having a bit of fun, building something cool, having a bit of crack, enjoying your life. Like, otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. I think you need to get into a mindset as well that if you want it badly enough, like, you'd be okay if it fails. Mm. So if you try and fails, that you can reconcile with that.
Exactly.
For a very long time, you know, I didn't want to do something unless, you know, it was a sure thing. And then I got into the headspace that, well, if I don't do it, I'll regret it. So, you know, give it a go. If it fails, fails. You can get a job again.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's the worst that can happen?
Exactly, yeah.
David, that was an absolutely brilliant chat. Where can people learn more about Property Bridges, maybe get involved, and then yourself as well?
Yeah, propertybridges.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Perfect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Gary.